It is Christmas Eve. The year is 1906. Over a wide area, ship radio operators with earphones have been alerted by the crackle of distant messages in Morse code. And after a moment, they hear... That first radio transmission was brief but epic. It all started in Germany in the year 1888, when Heinrich Hertz first produced and detected radio waves. But much more was needed to transmit intelligence. That was achieved in a limited way in 1895, when Marconi succeeded in sending a message across his father's estate in Italy. In 1899, the New York Herald invited Marconi to this country to report by wireless the progress of the America Cup races off the New Jersey coast. That date, 1899, has a special significance for me, for it was the year of my birth. So I can lay claim to a rather dubious distinction that my whole lifespan coincides with the entire period of commercial use of radio in this country. The transmission of voice by wireless must have intrigued experimenters very early. Fessenden claimed to have accomplished it in December of 1900, but only after he had the first Alexanderson alternator 6 years later was radio telephony a practical reality and the epic Christmas broadcast of O Holy Night possible. In 1906, DeForest hit upon the idea of interposing a grid of platinum wire between the filament and plate of the Fleming valve, creating the first radio tube. While its ramifications were not all immediately apparent, truly it was the key to a modern scientific and industrial revolution and loosed a flood of discovery and invention in the field of radio communication. A little later, I and a friend began to comprehend the age of electricity. Our first accomplishment was a Morse telegraph system between our homes. It didn't work very well, likely because of the many questionable splices we made in our discarded, rusty iron telegraph wire. But our eyes were opened to a new world, the mystery and magic of radio. We lived 1,000 miles from where everything was happening, so sources of information were few. But I discovered the Experimenter magazine and acquired treasured catalogs of the Electro Importing Company of New York and the William B. Duck Company of Toledo. My few pennies went for gadgets and hardware such as a coherer, headphones, and the like, which I couldn't very well make. Gradually, during my high school days, the elements of a rudimentary ham station were acquired or built. Operators and station licenses were unheard of, but it didn't matter. There was no one within listening range of my feeble spark transmitter, and there apparently was no other transmitter near enough for me to hear, if indeed I ever succeeded in locating the cat whisker on the sensitive spot of my Galena crystal. When World War I intervened, I was at the University of Minnesota attending the first course in radio theory. A month before the Christmas holiday of my junior year, KDKA of Pittsburgh had made broadcasting history by airing the results of the Harding Cox presidential election. That was on November 2nd, 1920. A few friends and I eagerly listened with earphones.
Running well ahead of Cox and Roosevelt. At the present time, Harding has collected more than 16 million votes against some 9 million for the Democrats. We'll give you the state vote in just a moment. But first, we'd like to ask you to let us know if this broadcast is reaching you. Please drop us a card, address station KDKA, Westinghouse, East Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
By the end of 1921, just a year later, there had been 30 broadcast licenses granted by Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, all for operation on 360 meters. By March 1923, only 14 months later, there were 566 stations licensed, truly a period of explosive growth and the birth of network broadcasting. Let's go back to October 17, 1919. With government encouragement, the three largest domestic competitors in radio communication, namely AT&T, General Electric, and Westinghouse, joined to become the Radio Corporation of America. The twin objectives were achieved of a strong U.S.-owned operating company and avoidance of a patent war that threatened technological progress. The early 1920s was a period of great activity. The popular magazine of radio was Radio News, edited by the prolific writer and prognosticator Hugo Gernsback. Commenting in July 1922 about the great surge in the radio parts business, he said, "It is our opinion that the radio business will be a very healthy one for several years to come." That was probably his most conservative utterance. In August that year, Gernsback ran an article entitled, "Advertising by Radio, Can It and Should It Be Done?" The conclusion was no. In January 1923, Gernsback asked whether radio sets could be sold as a complete outfit, like a phonograph or a Ford car. "To our minds," he said, "radio can never become standardized. Radio is in an experimental stage, and we hope it will always remain so, as it is precisely this phase that makes it so fascinating." The needs of World War I communications inspired the invention of the superheterodyne receiver by Major Edwin H. Armstrong. By 1924, the first superheterodyne broadcast receivers were offered by RCA. It has since become the standard mode of reception. One of amateur radio's greatest achievements occurred on December 7, 1921. That night, Paul F. Godley first heard transatlantic radio signals from an American amateur station. He had been sent to Scotland to conduct listening tests with superheterodyne receivers. All in all, he logged the signals from 6 Spark transmitters and 26 CW transmitters. 1922 was full of transatlantic listening achievements, but it remained until November 27, 1923, before two-way amateur communication was a reality between Leon Deloy in France and Fred Schnell in Hartford, Connecticut. Still more notable was it that whereas previous records were established on 200 meters or longer wavelengths, this one was on 100 meters, not long before then considered unusable. It was the beginning of the shortwave era, opening up the vast area of VHF, UHF, and microwave we know today. Amateur radio is fully credited with having shown the way. I dwell on these events at such length, not alone for the memories they evoke of these historic years, but verbally to paint a scene, the one which my generation found itself viewing upon graduation from college and university in the early 20s. Certainly, in the field of radio, whatever segment one might choose, opportunity was everywhere, if only it could be recognized. It is easy to see in retrospect, after the picture has been fully developed. That wasn't so plain, just a strong feeling in October 1923, when, in partnership with my bride of a few months, the E.F. Johnson Company began business with a few hundred dollars worth of radio parts, a bedroom office, and a few square feet of rent-free space for stock and workroom. Hardly anything could have been less auspicious. Depression days, the 30s, were hard. Yet, by 1936, we were able to build our first factory and office building of 8,000 square feet, and that fall moved into it with 17 employees. Our components were being designed into equipments that were eventually needed in volume for the approaching World War II. Before that was over, we had multiplied our facilities and reached a maximum of 500 employees and had gained invaluable experience and a host of friends. From the early days, components have been the foundation of our business, specialties such as vacuum tube sockets, inductors, and particularly variable capacitors, where Johnson is today the best-known name. Our customers include the greatest manufacturers in the radio electronics industry, and our product line continues to expand to serve their increasingly technical needs. About 1947, we concluded it was time that someone should manufacture a complete amateur transmitter. And who better than Johnson? We had extensive transmitter experience from the war, and we had many of our components already in production. The Viking 1 transmitter followed and was an immediate success. We were really on our way. Then, with the advent of television, came a period of abject gloom over all amateur operators. TV was the modern marvel. When reception was poor, as it was frequently, irate viewers blamed it on interference by ham stations and threatened to shut them down. Fortunately, technical solutions prevailed. Ham radio didn't die after all, but flourished as never before, and Johnson continued to produce numerous models of Viking amateur transmitters. In 1958 came a development which, for the first time, brought personal radio communication potentially to millions of people. I refer to the Class D Citizens Radio Service. Johnson products, marketed under the trade name Messenger, have enjoyed very great success in this area of radio, used by some 5 million people. Class D CB is attractive to those who use their radios for purely personal pleasure, but innumerable serious needs are being served. Highway safety is one of these. Numerous volunteer groups are using CB for public service activities. Professional men who need to keep in touch with home or office while on the road, farmers and smaller businesses, all have found it saves real time and money along with improved service to customers.
407 is 10-7 Medical
X. A product line of major importance to Johnson is that of FM and AM landmobile radio, the kind used in taxicabs, police cars, commercial over-the-road trucks, contractors' equipment, and innumerable other applications. Licenses in the public safety category for land transportation in the business industrial field, aviation, and marine services total some 700,000. If that seems to be a large number, it is only a promise of what will come. And in this field of landmobile radio, the E.F. Johnson Company finds its greatest growth opportunity. Today, in great contrast with the beginning 50 years ago, we find ourselves with excellent plants and facilities of over 250,000 square feet in Waseca, Minnesota, and Coral Gables, Florida, where over 1,000 good people are working. The original capital of $2,500 has developed into a business volume today of $25 million. Added to this, prospects for the future have never appeared brighter. Viewing this fascinating parade for what is getting to be a long lifetime, I am repeatedly struck with the realization of my good fortune. Radio has been good for me, personally, and it has been good for mankind. There is reason for great hope that we will go on from here to realize the enormous promise of radio in helping people solve their problems and differences through better communications.